Continuous intelligence is fast becoming a modern enterprise trend. In this episode, we talk to industry analyst George Gilbert on how big data is shaping the move towards continuous intelligence and whether it will drive us towards an autonomous enterprise kind of a future. In this episode of Swimstream's podcast, I'm talking with George Gilbert and Simon Crosby. George and Simon, introduce yourself. And George, can you tell us what you're doing now and also your past history as an analyst?
So right now, I'm actually trying to put together something that's a cross between Ben Thompson's Stratechery. He's focused on mostly consumer online services, and I want to focus on digital transformation and the use of AI, but I want to make it visual, like Mary Meeker's annual sort of internet trends report.
Wow.
And so the goal is that you don't have to be drowning in text. There's plenty of that around, and I want to make it something high bandwidth where you can convey pictures.
I'm Simon Crosby. I'm CTO at Swimrun AI and keen to be here and to learn from George. Thanks.
I think George is the right person to talk to regarding the topic we have today. And George, can we lay out the landscape? Can you talk about some of the big data trends you're seeing in the market? It will be great if we can talk about some of the traditional ways of doing handling big data, and then compare it with what's happening today in the market with the modern architectures.
So just to set some context and a little bit of history, going back maybe 10 years when we first started talking about big data in a big way, it turned out that we were basically building on technology that the very largest tech firms themselves had used, and that the technology they were using was either for running their online services or I should say for the services themselves to create the services, but it was also to operate them. And then that technology found its way from Yahoo to Cloudera and some related companies, where they tried to package that technology up for commercial companies to use themselves. And it took a few years, but we realized mainstream companies could not handle that complexity.
Cloudera had great results yesterday, but but yes, but you know, they pride before the fall.
It stalled out just sort of at the biggest, most sophisticated companies.
Mm-hmm. And is that a skill set thing just generally from kind of cloud infrastructure?
I do think it was a skill set thing in the sense that there were so many piece parts that there was many programming models that were new, and that the administration sort of complexity from all those piece parts was also tremendous. And today we're with sort of stream processing and analytics, trying to get to sort of more real-time apps. We're really we're repeating the same process where we're taking much of the software that the big tech companies are using now to try and monitor their operations in real time, and we're sort of tossing it over the wall, and we haven't hit the wall yet in terms of mainstream companies realizing they can't handle it, but we seem to be heading in that same direction, that same sort of complexity, the difficulty of the programming model, the difficulty of the administration model.
Mm, awesome. I agree with you on all those. I would add to that just that, you know, when big data started, the arrival rate of data was quite low, and now it's just nuts.
And latency, every sort of microsecond matters, and you know, there's the Databricks guys did a lot of work with Spark to try and reduce the latency there, but it's still, you know, a heavyweight cluster. And
the processing mode is still batch. I mean, it's the idea that you can stick everything on a disk and then think about it later, right? So store, then analyze. It's fundamentally flawed, at least as far as I'm concerned.
And even like with Kafka, which where they claim to, you know, trying to take every millisecond seriously, it's same. It's actually a worse problem because, as you pointed out, they
so wait up. I in my head at least, Kafka is just a piece of delivery infrastructure. It doesn't do any thinking, right? It doesn't understand the semantics of an event, and there are a whole bunch of good and bad things about that. So I think of Kafka as primarily about PubSub as a paradigm. So yay, that's good. Lots of things can pub and lots of things can sub, but it doesn't do the thinking. And the ability to do the thinking is still very limited. In the Kafka world, it's KSQL, which is kind of a long-running SQL query, which is just horrendous to run and very expensive. But anyway.
And I assume, just extending that comment, is like with a DBMS, you're polling essentially. That's not an event-driven kind of process. Something at the top is running and rerunning that query, I assume. Anyway,
sure, all the time. Yeah.
There's a lot of latency built in, and as you said, since it's just a pub sub piece of infrastructure, it's hard, if not impossible, for an application to know how fast events are coming in.
That's a huge problem. By the way, so the event queuing idea is kind of neat, but here are some problems. You don't get to decide beforehand as a consumer how many things are going to pub, right? And so you could be merely making your way down the queue and be arrive at the critical information too late because you don't have an ability to dynamically provision compute to keep up. That's one. The other one is that there's this fatal assumption that a single event is of interest. And, you know, it isn't. A light goes red. But if the light goes red and this and that and the next thing, then scream blue murder.
Right.
And they don't do that.
And I think the idea is that that's often used in conjunction with a database.
It absolutely is. And by the way, in Spark, you have to do it too. In the middle of every Spark application is something that takes data and converts it to state in some model and then jams it in database, often Cassandra or something, right? So something that's pretty fast. And all of these models, all the Lambda functions, everything are all about taking data, updating some model in a database, and then, something has to compute. But the problem is, how do you trigger the thing to go and compute?
So does it mean that bringing compute closer to where the data is generated is the solution? Or what are some of the modern trends you're seeing that overcomes some of the problems you highlighted?
So my understanding is when we talk about edge compute and edge intelligence, it's sort of like where we've gone from mainframe based, which was all centralized in the sort of big data approach, and client server maybe to three tier client server where the edge is kind of like the client, but you're still sort of the developer and the administrator are still basically mapping the application and the management of it to specific hardware infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And
which is a huge problem if things are mobile. You know, so it's fine if you know the network where all the data is coming from and you're plugged into it. But if the thing is mobile and it could show up over the internet, good luck.
And you know, Simon, I've actually spent some time trying to learn about the latest technology and application performance management and sort of AI ops. And what's interesting about that is, you know, as these distributed applications and even the sort of ones that are trying to go low latency, as it become more and more complex, people are trying to apply AI and managing them because the DevOps is so complicated. Right. But the problem with this AI ops is you really need to understand the topology and the behavior of all the components. And the more you can go deep on one piece, the sort of less you can go deep. You just sort of peanut butter deep on the other parts. And if you have I don't know if this is how Swim works, but if you understand you have this one platform that runs end to end, you can sort of observe its behavior and its topology, and you can adjust them as needed.
Yeah, so I mean, that's what Swim does, but Swim, I mean, I have kind of a problem with DevOps in the sense that it still mixes infrastructural abstractions with the app, okay? And in the Swim world, we are very religious about separating the app from the infrastructure and then making sure the infrastructure serves the app automatically with the right abstraction. So a key thing in Swim is a web agent, which you could think of as an actor in the actor model, right? They automatically migrate close to where data is arriving from. Yeah, it's the right thing to do, but they don't have to think about it. You know, Swim just does it for them. And so that notion of no ops, kind of a no ops fabric for running these big apps, it seems to me is important.
And so I guess my observations last question would be that in the conventional sort of distributed computing technology, because these are these sort of multi-vendor components that only loosely fit together, that sort of no ops approach wouldn't be possible because you can't, or it would be extremely difficult to have an intelligence that could look at how everything's operating and so dynamically adjust it.
Couple of things. First of all, I'm a huge fan of Kubernetes as a bridge between, say, hybrid or multi-cloud environments, right? It gives us at least some level of abstraction we can rely on. And if we can get provisioned, we're done. So our largest customer at the moment runs in AWS. We're running on EKS, which is their managed Kubernetes, but that doesn't span availability zones. And so we span the availability zones at a higher level, which is building the Swim fabric. So even though we have to get manually provisioned in East and West and so on, at the application level, Swim then provides these two abstractions, one which is the application infrastructure, which then spans the availability zones, and then the app itself.
But you're the one under the covers managing the sort of the infrastructure that might be either a hardware abstraction or like conventional Kubernetes, like who's ever using Swim doesn't see any of that.
Actually, they just roll us out using their Kubernetes. We're using whatever managed Kubernetes service they use, which is the Amazon EKS one. And funnily enough, the group that runs EKS is seen very much as an infrastructure group, and they have no call whatsoever on the application folk. They just do what they're told. It's a bit like VMs in the old days.
Yeah, let's shift some gear and talk about continuous intelligence. I think the term is fast gaining traction as an enterprise trend. So I would like to hear from both of you what the term means to you, especially from an enterprise context.
To me, I actually first started hearing about continuous applications from the Databricks guys going back probably four years. But they were also complaining that customers were really holding their feet to the fire when customers would say they want sort of real-time capabilities, and this is sort of a heavyweight, it's a enough of a heavyweight platform. The idea, I guess, the idea being that you want to be able to take incoming data continuously and reflect on it, make predictions or prescriptions, but you also often need to be able to accumulate some amount of history, either for later contextual analysis or for use elsewhere in the application. And running those in combination and keeping them consistent is not easy. And to do it with really, really low latency is probably the hardest part.
Yeah. What is your take on continuous intelligence? And George pointed out, you sort of gain intelligence from the real-time data that is streaming in, and occasionally use the historical data to gain some context. So my question, which I would like to add to the previous one, is how much of this historical data is needed to really make continuous intelligence useful for organizations?
Okay, so let me tackle that one head on. You know, you really don't care that last Tuesday morning at 8:07, the light was green. You really don't care, okay? But you care that the light can predict what it's going to do in the next 2 minutes, say. So how much of the past do you need? Actually, what you need is a digest of the past, which is what you managed to learn or however, whatever form of analytic you're computing. You don't need the raw data, okay? So this, we've got the silly assumption that to analyze things, we always have to have the raw data and always go back to it. No, we don't. We learn on the fly, okay? So there's a very important new class of algorithms called sketches, which allow you to derive statistics for streaming data. They're way cool. But we do similar things for continuous learning and so on. And some of our customers have got their own analytics, which they want to run, but they just run them continuously. And so for me, the fundamental shift in continuous intelligence is from store and then analyze to continuously analyze and react. Okay, and that's a big deal.
And so this is like, taking edge intelligence to the extreme where it's wherever sort of smart connected entities are and having them process locally so that you get the inference.
So let's talk about where for a sec. In my view, the first opportunity you get to look at the data, and often that is the cloud. So where is edge intelligence? The edge is not a place. It's certainly not a device. If the device is a 30-year-old traffic light, right? It's not a place if the device is mobile. So in general, what the application needs to be able to do is get hold of data and pick it apart. By the way, a lot of data will be encrypted, so you won't get to process it on the way between, you know, the device and the cloud. So you edge processing happens wherever you get to pick the data apart, ideally close to where the data is generated. And that's often the cloud.
Okay, what are some of the tangible business value organizations can get by embracing continuous intelligence? They have so many data sources. So let us assume they find a way to bring them all together and get useful intelligence. So what are some of the tangible business values they can get?
So let me take a cut at that one, since I'm trying to start from my own research at the big picture of what digital transformation means. And the best definition I've seen so far starts from the creating a digital representation of sort of key things in an organization, such as your customers, your operations, mm-hmm. your products and your assets, even your employees. And that digital representation, at some point in the past, we called it digital twins, but that became associated with this kind of heavyweight industrial kind of asset. And when you have these digital representations, with continuous intelligence, you can do things like perhaps on behalf of customers, you can anticipate or inform their own decisions. With operations, which can be a composition, a very complex and large scale composition of entities, you can optimize how those operations work. One well-known example is what a fulfillment center at Amazon looks like, where they model things for maximum efficiency. And I would imagine that the more data and the better the models we have for representing all these types of things in a business, the better we can do at it's not just optimizing it, but it's making all the pieces fit together, which is inherently what strategy is all about.
That's cool. So there's this digital twin consortium which has popped up, right? And I listened to one of the webcasts. Its initial ambition appears to be more to, I guess, define an ontology of things, right? And then because it's the object management group, it's obviously focused on management first. Whereas the notion of intelligence, at least in the swim world, is that we're continuously computing cool things that are interesting or useful. That is that these things are concurrent and not just objects to be managed.
So just a question on not just managing, but that let's say you are talking about an industrial device like a power turbine. You could have a bunch of swim web agents that represent different components of it.
Sure.
That are essentially modeling how it's operating. In this case, it might be for predictive maintenance, but it could also be, like you want to model how it's running because you might want to tune it for maximum energy efficiency or for, maximum power output.
So in the swim world, the key thing is this, that individual digital twins are only modestly interesting. They can each process their own data and safely represent the thing. What's really interesting is when they are related to one another and they compute not only on their own data, but also on the data that is visible to them courtesy of the relationships. And these relationships are inherently fluid. So let me give you a cool example. In Dubai, we do some interesting work with traffic. And one of the apps does this. When a truck with bad braking behavior is approaching, and an inspector on the street tells the inspector, okay. So every time you get a GPS update from the truck, you have to recompute this notion of, does it have bad braking behavior? And the notion of, is it approaching, is an affine calculation, which is a geospatial, a geofence plus the distance decreasing. It's continually calculated, right? So the relationship is kind of like a graph of, this truck is now near you, so I'm going to build a relationship. And it's continuously computed. In the swim case, it's all in memory. So we're going at CPU speed, CPU memory speed. So it's literally millions of times faster.
Simon, it's funny that you mentioned that because I wanted to borrow an example that you talked about in telco, but that was also the sort of defining example that that the Paul Maritz's spin out of VMware, Pivotal, talked about when they finally shipped their software. They said, here's what we can do that has never been possible before. We can offer a telco the ability to monitor their customers and their operations so that if a customer has lost a connection and they're a good customer, that the customer service agent can in real time give them a credit and, you know, take care of the best customers. And then when you told me about what sounds like either a large scale pilot or full production, that it turned out that the telcos could only, that the best latency they could do with that sort of big data approach, which was the Hadoop ecosystem, was 4 to 5 hours.
That's right.
And that you've got it now down to under a second. That's the difference, one, between the store and analyze approach using the old big data software, but it's also the difference between the programming model that was, you know, the programming and operational model that was impossibly complicated that fell apart ultimately.
Good. Well, thank you. So yeah, it still hasn't been deployed nationwide, but it's dealing with four petabytes a day. Okay, that's a ton. But here's the thing. The cloud is awesome because of REST and databases. REST means any old server can do the work for me, and database means we're not going to forget, right? It's also terrible because of that. So if I'm doing, I don't know, traffic predictions or something at 30,000 events a second, which is Las Vegas style, sure, there's 5,000 servers in AWS Lambda that can deal with that for me. But to get to Lambda and then get the database updated, I'm looking at that about 175 turn milliseconds per event. You know, it's just stupid. By the way, that's 10 million times slower than doing it on my old PC close to where the data came from. Okay, it's just horrendous. The moment you reach out to a database, you're going 10 million times slower. Okay. And that's, people just don't think of that. And this REST notion and statelessness means that, yeah, you know, you're throwing performance to the wind.
Yeah, that's so sort fundamentally, of brings into my,
go ahead.
Brings into my next question, which is architectural consideration for sort of like ensuring continuous intelligence. So can you build on what you're saying right now and talk about what are some of the architectural considerations any organization should take into account as they tap into their data for continuous intelligence?
I guess Swim is lucky in the sense that we don't care about databases generally, right? Or at least they're used to pre-populate things. But at runtime, everything's in CPU memory. And so moving things around at runtime is easy. That is, we're not constrained by where we happen to choose to place a database. And that's really easy. So the Swim is really advantaged by the fact that the entire model is to build a distributed graph of these web agents, which are concurrent digital twins, I guess, that link to each other, but they're all in memory all the time.
So the use of in-memory is to reduce the latency, or there are other advantages to it?
It reduces latency for sure, but it also allows these concurrent web agents to compute on their own data continuously, right? So in general, you could represent a thing, a mobile device, a traffic light, as a row in a database, but it's not going to independently compute for you. In Swim, a web agent is a process, and it can decide to compute when it receives new data or at some point in the future. And so they're independent concurrent things which run whenever they need to.
Okay. So George, what are some of the architectures you're seeing as organizations try to build a continuous intelligence platform?
Well, the thing that seems to be common is trying to stretch some of the artifacts that we've used in the past. Like in-memory databases became possible because sort of memory is cheaper, and so we can process within a database faster, but that's still a database by its nature still has a huge amount of overhead because it's designed to sort of mediate concurrent access to data. And even if you model things in the DBMS in memory, one, you have the sort of the network latency, and then two, you have the overhead of the DBMS, as wonderful as it might be.
And if you do the big model, it's inherently going to be cluster-based, right? Or distributed.
Yes.
So yes. The moment you hit a network, you're in trouble.
Yes.
And so distributed two-phase commit, that goes as the slowest thing, which is the network.
Yeah. So the idea is that even if you have these more than clever, you know, what seems like a revolutionary evolution of a traditional artifact, it really doesn't keep up with what's going to be sort of coming. It's sort of like when we had, you know, client server, we had a couple hundred million clients, but once we had mobile devices, you know, cell phones, we had billions, and you just couldn't. I mean, they're also mobile, so you couldn't support them the same way. And so now, as we have more and more smart, you know, connected devices, you can't connect them and sort of manage all the data coming off them with a DBMS, no matter how much of a scale out architecture it has.
Yeah, there are other things with databases which I think are really interesting. For example, if the relational databases capture obvious things like trucks of engines, but you know, a truck being close to an inspector, that's a dynamic thing which is computer on the fly. They don't do that. But what's truth? You know, for the real world that we're looking at, often it's a distribution or something that you've learned from tons of data on the fly, right? So the notion that the database holds an instantaneous truth about a thing is it's a bit of a mismatch. The other one is that time is fundamental in all of these modern applications. You know, data arrives over time. Insights are computed over time and so on. And so a database as an instantaneous state store doesn't really make sense. And finally, databases don't compute. They don't actually initiate computation.
Yeah, we are coming closer to the end of the podcast, so let's make some predictions. Continuous intelligence plus large-scale automation leads to business autonomy. So do you expect organizations to become autonomous in the next 10 years? If yes, what will be the impact on the society in terms of jobs and everything else?
Let me take a first crack at that one, which is one thing that we haven't talked a lot about is the fact that with AI applications, we're discovering that they're not quite the same as traditional software applications because the models vary a fair amount between entities and between customers. And whereas software, you know, you build it once and you stamp it out at essentially zero marginal cost. Like an example of what the problem is with a model, like if you build a model for interpreting scans from an MRI for one hospital, it's not quite the same as at another hospital because the machines are just different, the way they're calibrated, the artifacts they might have. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting about SWIM was that each web agent can learn on its own model can be learning. So you don't have to have, it sort of solves the problem of models not being consistent or essentially shareable across
instances. And they're simpler.
Yes.
Here's an example of a simple model. Do you like blueberry muffins? Don't call your mom. Call your mom and find out if you like blueberry muffins. You've learned over your lifetime, and you do or you don't. But your experience is enough to say whether or not you like blueberry muffins, right? And so the SWIM idea is like the composition of lots and lots of small models.
One question that, there are some times where you want a model that collects data from as many sort of instances of running or data reporting entities like autonomous driving. But I'm assuming SWIM can also sort of accommodate those instances, but there's just got to be sort of some more, say, developer intervention to do that.
So ultimately my view of, to go back to Krish's question, is that we make this stuff real by not adopting an approach where we need infinite numbers of AI experts and so on. These things have got to develop themselves, right? So digital representations of me have got to learn about me. And the cool thing about SWIM is that we can summarize then appropriately the behavior of a thing completely and very, very compactly. It can all be in memory and it can learn and continually adjust that, right? To the extent that's relevant. So our largest application right now does this for millions, hundreds of millions of mobile devices, right? So they learn and predict where they're going to be. And we maximize connection.
I think with that, we have come to the end of the podcast. It was great chatting with you, George and Simon, and I really learned a lot. And looking forward to having you in another podcast sometime in the future.